Session number 13426, Harold van der Wolf, Reel 4.
Mr. van der Wolf, Reel 4. We were talking about the attack made by the 9th Battalion, DLI, on the 14th of June 1944 on the village of Lingèvre. Now, what happened next? You were halfway across this cornfield.
Well, we were getting casualties. Some felt that our artillery lifted 200 yards instead of 100. And that our platoon officer thought we had slowed down. We hurried a bit, and then apparently what was happening was that the Germans were aware of the artillery opening up and would come in front of the artillery and move back with it. I mean, still getting casualties, but not as severe. And it was rumored that the artillery got the hang of this and had gone forward 200 yards, then came back 100. We had moved up a little bit too fast, and it was always considered by some of our blokes that some of our casualties was inflicted by our own artillery, but I've got no proof of that. It's the general feeling we had, because we had to suddenly put a spurt on. But I might be completely and utterly wrong, but that's the feeling we had, and that was the general feeling amongst quite a lot of us, that our own artillery had caused some of our casualties. Not intentionally, obviously. But, well, then we got into the village, and
so you were just facing, during the crossing of this cornfield up to the village, you were just facing artillery fire.
That's right.
No small arms or mortar fire. Never worked.
Well, there was mortar and artillery fire, and tanks, of course. We soon came across tanks.
Could you see the tanks as you were crossing the field?
Oh, yeah, we could see the tanks in the village. And we got into a dip as we entered the village, and there was a sniper in the church tower. And I know this corporal shouted, "What's this tower? What's the tower?" And the chap standing... We'd had a chap join the platoon the day before, who had been sent up from the artillery, because we'd obviously had casualties. And there was some reinforcement. And this chap was sent up from the artillery, and he was a chap about 40-odd. And he obviously had had no infantry training at all, because we were in this ditch, whereas we were pressing up against the side of the ditch nearest the village, you know, so that we couldn't be seen. He stood in the middle of the ditch, and he had a sniper's bullet straight between the eyes. He was killed. But no infantryman would have been standing where he stood. You know, you could look up and say, why did the sniper pick on him when there were four or five of us in the same area? But the other four or five of us weren't targets, because we had done what an infantryman should do.
Now, had you had anything to fire at this stage, or were you just, at the moment, carrying your
weapon? At the moment, just carrying the weapon. We actually got into the village, and that's when I killed my first German. He was a sniper in a tree, and I spotted him and shot him with I put a round into him, you know. From the Bren. And the corporal shouted to me and said, we didn't want any firing. And I said, well, there was a sniper in the tree. Well, with that, the sniper fell. And, you know, it was a good job I spotted him, really. But for years, I could see that chap falling out of a tree. You see, I'd been brought up in a fairly strict, well, not strict religious, but I had a religious upbringing. Not to kill him, the first German. I didn't even have to think about it. I could just see the book falling out the tree for years. I had to see a psychiatrist, who advised me to go back to the scene, which I did eventually, and I never saw the chap falling out the tree ever since. I actually went back and saw the tree.
So it was certainly not something you'd done lightly.
No. I mean, I must have killed quite a few after that, because we were greeted with them.
But it was the first one that had the real effect on you.
It's the first German that I actually knew I'd shot, and it left an impression on me, there's no doubt about that.
So he'd fallen out of the tree.
Yeah.
And what happened next then?
Well, the next thing, we saw a crowd of Germans walking across a field, obviously not aware that we were where we were.
That's from the other side of the village.
And the corporal gave us instructions not to fire until he said so. Well, I mean, I think there's about 20 to 25 Germans, and we just mowed them down. Now, that doesn't stick out a lot in my memory. It's the first one that I killed that bothered me.
And you must have, if you'd been opening up with a Bren on this crowd.
That's right, I must have shot quite a few of them. Because, they were getting 15 rounds at them in next to no time. And there was blokes opening up with rifles. But we waited until they were nearly on us, really.
Now, you said there were tanks in the village. What had happened to them? Sorry, I should have picked that up.
Yeah, well, the tanks were... we were in a village, and
is actually Lingers.
Lingers. Now, there was a hill the other side of the village, which was really our objective. And the tanks were on top of the hill, firing down into the village.
So they weren't in the village itself?
No, they moved into the village in the counterattack.
You got the village, you could see the tanks, they were firing down on you.
That's right. Well, it was then that we learnt that our CO had been killed, Colonel Wood, whom I never met.
Where was he killed? Was it in one of these attacks?
He was killed by a mortar fire.
Now, your company had come straight across the cornfield.
That's right.
A and C, I think, you said, were going through the woods. To the same target.
That's right, all making the same...
Had they arrived when you got there?
We were fairly well abreast.
So you were supported?
Mm-hmm. That's right.
Now, did you then... You'd shot these Germans coming across up to the village. Did you then make your advance on the... Was it possible to make an advance on the hill at that stage?
Well, no, it wasn't. What happened was that... Major Mogg had taken over command of the battalion, and he had decided that we had to go up and knock out these tanks. There were two of them that we could see, and he came around and he said, right, you and you come with me. There was conversation about who was going to fire the pit. I didn't volunteer that I was a marksman with a pit because I thought I might miss. In any case, I was on the Bren. He took a pit. This lieutenant, whose name I couldn't remember, took a pit. I went up with a Bren gun, and there were six of us altogether.
Three riflemen.
That's right.
You were picked out. You weren't volunteers.
You come with me. You come with me.
So it wasn't going to be a general attack on the hill and the tanks on the hill.
No.
This was a patrol.
To go up and knock out two tanks. They obviously had the two pits loaded. Now the idea of the Bren gun and the rifle was to fire at the slots that the tank people look out of, because they don't like a bullet getting in there, so they shut down and go blind. And we went up across a field.
Were you making it a covert approach? I mean, trying not to be seen.
We were keeping close to the hedge, and we sort of kept low and went up this field. And we came to a load of railings around sort of Mother Mary cross. You know, there's a lot of them things in France. And we got down behind this one.
Had the Germans spotted you yet?
No, the Germans hadn't spotted us. And the tanks then were, well, you could almost touch them. I mean, they must have been within the range of 15 yards. And Major Mogg fired first at one tank, and it absolutely blew up. He'd really done the job. The lieutenant fired at the other one and only damaged it, knocking out its track. What we weren't aware of was that there was another tank around the corner who came round to see what was doing. So we just took tail and ran. And we ran down the hill, down the field, and flung ourselves into a ditch at the bottom of the hill. I remember there was a graveyard behind us. And with that, the tanks started opening up, firing their 88mm guns down towards the ditch. And funny enough, we were more frightened of the, because they were landing in the graveyard, and we were more worried about chunks of concrete, you know, from the graveyard that were flying around. But then a group of us got cut off. The tanks moved into the village.
So the tanks came, there was one tank was out of it, another tank had a damaged track.
That's right, he couldn't move, but he could fire.
And the third tank?
Well, he came down along with some others.
So some more arrived?
There were more tanks, yeah.
So they moved into the village?
Into the village. And
where were you relative to the village in this graveyard? That was right by the village.
That's right.
The graveyard was next to the church.
That's right, we were right in the village. Yeah. And for some reason, a gang of us had got into a ditch, I can remember. I mean, other things had happened, which I can't recall, but eventually there was a group of us got into a ditch. And there were about five tanks in the same field. We were in the ditch at the edge of the field. And these Germans were outside their tanks yapping, or else up in the cannon tower, you know, talking. And well, we realised that we were on a hide into nothing, because tanks don't take prisoners. We could only wait and see if the infantry came through and took us prisoner. We really thought that we were going to be taken prisoner. We'd had our chips, really. And there was a sergeant who, well, I don't know if I should say this, really, he got the military medal. But in fact, he was saying, give ourselves up, give ourselves up. And there was a Scottish corporal who threatened to scat them down. And it was to knock them down, you know, keep them quiet. But it was the Scottish corporal who held us together. He should have got the MM. But there we are.
Now, where were the rest of the battalion?
Don't know. I mean, they were around the village somewhere.
And you were right isolated down to your
That's
little
right.
group.
That's right.
Was Mogg with you?
Oh, no. No, he wasn't in that group.
So he'd
left us. This was a little while afterwards, you
see. And you're not quite sure of the circumstances.
No, I'm not.
One thing I forgot to ask, when they'd opened up with the Piets on the tanks, had you opened up with your Bren?
I put my Bren on to single shots and fired at the blokes getting out the tank, burning the tank. Now, this book tells you that Mogg fired at his revolver. That's not true, or not as I remember it. I fired my Bren on single shots.
Did you hit them?
I hit one bloke. The other got away.
Were you shooting at the slits as well?
No, didn't have to do that, as it happens, because, you know, the Moggy had really done the damage.
Now, going back to, or sort of going forward again then, to where you were in this rather grim situation, did you have any Piets with you, or any anti-tanks?
No.
So nothing you could do about these tanks?
Nothing we could do about it. And this corporal said, right, you know, everybody put their chocolate and their cigarettes and their tobacco and let's share it out, and there's no scrounging. If you're captured, you know, you take the chance. No scrounging, one off the other. Well, with that, our anti-tank artillery kept moved up, and the tanks were being fired on, and they dispersed, and we got out.
So the threat sort of dispersed as well. Yeah, minute you were...
1 minute we were thinking, well, we've had our chips, and the next minute we saw the tanks, a couple of them knocked out, and the rest making a...
Had the Germans seen you in this ditch?
No. Well, no, if they'd seen us, they'd have shot us for sure. You know.
How did you know the German tanks didn't take prisoners?
Well, they ain't got room to take prisoners. You know, they got nowhere to put them.
Was that their reputation then?
Well, that was the reputation that we were told by the corporal, you know. They don't take prisoners, boy.
The Scottish corporal?
The Scottish
corporal. So he told the sergeant that?
Well, he told us, yes, he told the sergeant quietly to shut up.
What happened?
Well, then this, of course, by this time, I got vague memories that we had taken the village, we had repelled counterattacks, and it was now quite late. And we had suffered a tremendous lot of casualties. I mean, we finished up losing, I think nearly 600 of us went into action that day. And 22 officers and 226 men were casualties. We lost 22 officers and 226 men in that action. And the Gloucester Regiment came in and got us out.
Now, those casualties had been suffered by all the companies. You hadn't seen a lot of... I mean, you'd been quite lucky in a sense that you hadn't been in an area where...
Well, in my section that started off, the 12 of us, there were 3 of us came out.
So you had been right in one of the worst sections.
Yeah.
Worst areas.
That's right. Only 3 of us came out of them.
How did you feel about that? I mean, because they were all Cornish lads, you'd said, as well.
Well, they were all from the Dukes. I mean, lot of the Dukes were from Bristol and all over the place. But one of them was... this Royal Artillery bloke that I talked about. But, I mean, this funny lad who said our names weren't on the... he was one that was killed. That felt very sad. And it wasn't until we were relieved by the Gloucester Regiment and taken back the line for a hot meal. And it wasn't until then that you were reporting what casualties you'd seen and what had happened to this one and that one that you realised what devastation you'd gone through. You know, you didn't really realise the casualties you'd had until it was sort of checking up time. And then we realised that we were very lucky to come out, particularly in my section. I mean, 3 out of 12, you know, you were very lucky. But I mean, the tots of brandy came up, and we had 2 tots instead of 1, and that's the way you look at it, really.
I wanted to ask generally, what were the arrangements for rations during this whole period of the Normandy campaign?
Hot meals were brought up under darkness, first thing in the morning, last thing at night. And between whiles, you may do with haversack rations like.
So what would the hot meals be?
Very nice. Well, sort of tin sausages, beans and things like that.
Stews
and all tin stuff, of course, all heated up. And you open up the tin and or else you had it dished out in... I mean, after this attack, it was dished out into your kit, and, you know, your proper billy cans.
And haversack rations, what was that?
Well, that was... basically what you could scrounge, like, you know, chocolate and, you see, you were given 2 good meals and you had rations of chocolate and biscuits and that to last you through the day. You weren't expected to eat very much during the action.
So that brings us to the end of the 14th that night. You know, you were relieved by the Gloucester.
That's right.
What's the next thing you remember?
Well, the next thing I remember was about 2 days afterwards, I was in a trench, one that we dug ourselves, one with Bren gun, and the corporal, the signal corporal, who had been a corporal in the signals in the Dukes, was now a corporal in the signals, was obviously out with some signalers doing some line laying or something, and with me were three other chaps who had also been in the signal training platoon. And the corporal said, "What are you chaps doing here?" So we said, "Well, we've been fighting a war, same as you, like, you know, corp." And he went on. Well, that tea time, the four of us were called back to HQ, to TAC HQ, to be interviewed by the signals officer.
TAC HQ, what's
that? Yeah. TAC HQ is the HQ that goes into the with the attack. You see, sorry. Normally, when you went into attack, companies took their turn to lead the attack. But each time, that company would be backed up by what is known as TAC HQ. That would include the CO and intelligence officer and the signalers, attack HQ and that sort of thing. Because when you went into an attack, the signalers laid out copper wire, very, very thin copper wire, which was never retrieved, and so that you could have telephones. When you consolidated your position, then you used what we call D5 cable, which was a much more permanent cable, and relayed the lines. But of course, you reeled that in when you moved away and repaired it and all that sort of thing. Anyway, this, we were called to see this officer. And there again, his name escapes me. And he said, "I want two of you to come back into the signal unit." So being the spokesman, I said, "Well, we'd better toss up for it, sir." And he said, "No, I want you. The other three will toss up between them." So the corporal must have put in a good word for me because of my being called King Harry, you know, Procedure King Harry, which I always laugh about. And so I joined the signal platoon and was attached from then onwards to TAC HQ. I never went out to a company as a signaler. I remained with TAC HQ, working with a CO and then the intelligence officer.
And the CO by then, that would be Mogg by then?
That would be Mogg. Because I took my turn going out laying lines and all that sort of thing. And if you laid a line...
How would you go about it? That's something, you know, how would you lay a line?
Well, this is something you've done in your training. You conceal it as you lay it out. You conceal it in the hedgerows and all that sort of thing. Tie it back and... and whoever laid the line was responsible for maintaining it. Now, one of the tricks the Germans would do would come in and cut a line and wait for you to come out to repair it and fire on you, you know. So you had to be very careful. Funny enough, being an infantry signaler was a good number in this country, but it wasn't a very comfortable number in action. I know I went on a night patrol and I had to carry an 18 set. Which was the infantry big set on the back on this night patrol, which wasn't a very good experience really, because you took an hour and a half to cross a field, you know, because you were crawling on your bellies, because they would send up very lights, and if it's the movement they see, you know, you can be standing up in a field, and provided when that light went, you stood perfectly still, you would look like a tree probably, you know, in the very light. But if you just moved an arm, then the enemy would see you. So, I mean, if you were sort of standing with one leg in the air, you daren't move until that light had gone out, because you'd be seen. We went to have a look at a place called Villers-Bocage.
Villers-Bocage,
B-O-C-A-G-E. We got into an area within range of the village. There was a patrol of about 12 of us, and we were heavily mortared. Now, the Germans obviously expected somebody to come into that area and had full view of us, and we had casualties out of the 12 of us. And the object of a night patrol, of course, is to try and take prisoner. That's the object of a night patrol. But we didn't see any Germans, but they certainly saw us. And we had to get back out of it.
And what would your job be as signaller on this patrol?
Well,
with the 18th?
Yeah, to keep communication. Because normally, you see, one, you have two signallers. One carries the set, and the other bloke operates it because it's behind you, you know. But on a night patrol, you don't keep it switched on, so that you operate it yourself, and you know, you take it off your back and operate it when you're in position, and you remain completely silent until the time as the officer wants to send back some messages or get advice.
And did he on that patrol?
Oh yes, because I had to let them know that we were being mortared. Yeah.
That was one part of your job. What about, you mentioned mending the line. What would that entail? That's a laid, I mean, that was a wireless set you were taking out there, 18. Mm. When you went out to repair a line, what would you do?
Well, normally two of you went to repair a line and a third one went as rifle cover. You know, in case of enemy action. I mean, his job, the third man's job, was to keep an eye open for the enemy. The two of you went tracing the line to try and find the fault.
Would you actually go along it with
you? You have to go along the line and examine it and try and find the fault.
Could you cue into the line to call back and forth to see
Yeah, because I remember we went out one night to repair a line, and we were inside a hedge, and there was a road, and we heard a movement the other side of the hedge. And we realised that a German patrol was coming in. And I teed in to the line and let the company know that that we suspected that a patrol had passed us on the way. Of course, the Germans used to come out in patrols of 24 to 25, whereas we used to go out in 12. The trouble, though, they had passed us, but when you go on patrol, you always leave a man a little way back as a waiting man or a getaway man, because one of the patrol must always get back to report what happened. Of course, we didn't know where the German had left their getaway man. And, I mean, it was no good us three trying to take on a patrol. We just lay doggo and let the patrol go through. Well, one long before they were spotted, and we heard them coming back again. Some of them had been shot, and the rest were skipping away back again. And we went on and found the fault in the line and mended it.
When you say teed into the line, you mean tapped it?
You actually got a system of scraping the line, and you can tee in. You know, you take off the cable casing, and you fix a wire and tee in. And then when you take off your tee, you just put the insulating tape around where you would remove the cover. I mean, it was nothing more than doing electrics, really, repairing a line and teeing in.
And when you found the link, you just tied it together?
You repaired it, yeah.
Which was easy, usually?
Well, not very difficult, no.
What other jobs did you have as signaller? Routine jobs, for instance?
Well, your routine job was maintaining equipment, wireless equipment, and keeping up with your procedures and keeping up with your morse.
Was the machinery reliable, steady? I mean, or was the things
The old 38 set, which was the one that went into a pouch, which was used between sections. That one used to get some trouble, but the 18 set, which you carry on your back, was quite a reliable instrument, actually. Because you could go on to bigger ones, 19 sets and 22s, but they were mostly carried in vans, so that the Royal Corps of Signals would use those.
The 18 set was a big one. It had a longer range than the 38.
That's right. That's right. It had a fair range of about 3 or 4 miles. But
and what would the 38s
Oh, that would be a matter of yards, I suppose.
And what was unreliable about it?
Well, it kept going wrong.
What was the main fault?
Well, the main fault was its batteries, I suppose.
What, just running out of faulty?
You get faulty batteries and the terminals used to rust up fairly quickly and that sort of thing.
So, any other routine jobs?
Not really. It was just basically maintaining equipment and, you know, looking after your stuff and repairing lines. And I mean, if you were back resting, you'd pull in your wires, your line. Well, then every cable was run through and tested and checked and repaired and all that sort of thing. That used to be quite a long job to do that with all your cable coming in, you know.